This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. Wherever you are and whoever you are listening, thank you. Happy early February to everyone. Today's episode is so good. We're bringing back a OG topic that has had tons and tons of updates. So this is immunotherapy part two, and special guest Matt McKenzie discusses what we should know when these patients present to the ICU. What exactly is immunotherapy? How do CAR T cells work? What is CRS and ICANS? Is corticosteroid treatment harmful? What are some grading differences? What are some common adverse effects from our immune checkpoint inhibitors? The role of pharmacists in prevention and treatment, and so, so much more. So this builds from the original immunotherapy episode with Heather May. So this is an awesome, awesome one. Other big announcement. The March Madness bracket returns this year. So some may remember I did a critical care medication March Madness bracket in 2020. Times passed, and I thought this idea needed to return. So no hints just yet on what the subject is, but know that we are not talking specific medications. So the only thing you'll get for now, but not sure there will be an episode I release where you learn as much as this one. So sit back and relax. Unless you're driving, then don't do that, because we're starting right now.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Very lucky to be joined by Matt McKenzie. Now, Matt is a critical care, nutrition support, clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Texas at MD Anderson Cancer Center. You can find him on Twitter at MGM485. Matt, thanks. How are you, man?
I'm great. Excited to be here. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I realized not only from your like Twitter handle, but also from your emails, you have a top tier initials. Like MGM is platinum. Like mine is NAP, for example, right? Which, hey, hand up, love a good NAP. But I feel like that's just a really great, you got a great set of initials. So just had to point that out for the listeners here. We're off on a strong foot, obviously.
Yeah, it's definitely initials. I always send my emails in. I'm always waiting for someone to respond and, hi, MGM, nice to meet you, but it hasn't happened yet. But no, it definitely coincides with the nice little casino there as well.
So we are talking about, it is titled Immunotherapy Part 2, because essentially, you know, Heather May joined initially to do a brief kind of intro into what that world even was, and a lot of that info was developing and all that kind of thing. So Matt is gracious enough to come back, and we'll still give kind of like an overview of things, but then really kind of update us as to where are we now, what kind of guideline recommended treatments are there, etc. And then get excited, because we have a Mattress Mac story part 2 to close the episode with. But Matt, starting out, immunotherapy, what is it exactly? Like, what is this umbrella term reference? Because to me, right, when I think of cancer and its classic treatment, I don't think of immunotherapy. I think of immunosuppression. So what is immunotherapy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, immunotherapy is very much what it sounds like. It's using your own immune system to fight cancer cells. And in layman's terms, this immunotherapy can help either boost or change how our immune system works, so it can actually target cancer cells. And for the sake of today's conversation, I know we'll be focusing a little bit more on checkpoint inhibitors and largely monoclonal antibodies, but also CAR T cell therapy. But, you know, for all intensive purposes, immunotherapy is an umbrella term that does encompass other treatments as well, including but not non-specific immunotherapies, oncolytic virus therapy, different T cell therapies, but also cancer vaccines as well. Some examples that you may have run across in the hospital or even heard on commercials probably or read about are PD-1 or PD-L1, CTLA-4 pathway agents. And these are checkpoint inhibitors that are not limited to durvalumab, ipilimumab, nivolumab, and pembrolizumab. And I know that's a mouthful, so we'll get into that in a little bit. I think instead of defining like immunosuppression for what it is, a better term to think about it would be something like immunomodulating. And for instance, these medications I talked about, most of them are PD-1 specific medication, and PD-1 is a receptor involved in immune checkpoint signaling, specifically T cell maintenance. Typically, this functions as an off switch that keeps T cells from attacking other cells in the body. However, when it binds to its ligand PD-L1, it lets the T cells leave other cells alone. However, some cancer cells express a large quantity of PD-L1. Which helps them evade this immune attack. So monoclonal antibodies in general that target these PD-L1s or PD-1 can block this binding and boost our immune system against cancer cells, just as an example of what you had asked about immunosuppression.
Thanks for kind of definitely filling, because I did not know that it encompassed that wide a variety of terms. And I also, tell me you're talking about a hemonc topic without telling me you're talking about a hemonc topic. We got a reference to a drug commercial, which is perfect. But you see them, like, that's the thing, is like, I see them around. So it's not, you're not just, making a joke there. Now, what types of cancers are immunotherapies kind of being used for? Maybe, obviously, if we're talking about the broad term of it, I'm sure it'd be a lot of them, but semi what we're talking about today, you know, I think initially it was ALL, refractory B-cell cancer, but I'm sure the indications have gotten wider from then till now.
Yeah, for sure. That's another good question, as, you know, honestly, it's one of the hardest topics to keep up with, because every day it seems like there's new information or there's another type of cancer we're treating with immunotherapy. But in general, the current list of FDA-approved immunotherapies to treat certain types of cancer are vast. There's probably almost 20 different types of cancers. I'll go through a couple of them, but a lot of them include B-cell lymphoma, relapse refractory non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, bile duct cancers, bladder cancers, breast, cervical, endometrial, colorectal, esophageal, head and neck cancers, Hodgkin's lymphomas, and the list goes on and on and on, but also include other hematologic malignancies like B-cell ALL, like you talked about, as well as relapse refractory B-cell ALL. But again, the list is vast and it continues to be expanded upon, it seems like, almost every month.
You mentioned that it's hard to keep up with. Yeah, shout out to you all in the hemonc ICU world. Not only do you have to keep up with the ICU topics, but you then somehow have to keep up with like the hemonc topics as well. Fill us in. Is there like a secret club where you all like share pronunciation tips and papers, or is it just every man and woman for themselves?
No, honestly, it's about coming up with abbreviations, learning from how the hemonc pharmacists say it, and making sure that we're not messing it up when we're saying it. But yeah, it's definitely practicing it over time to get better at it.
So as we describe, right, the chimeric antigen receptor T cell or CAR T cell therapy and what it is and how it works, I think it'd be good if we think about it from like two different perspectives, right? Like in vitro or like the lab, like how do we even make this to have it be a treatment? And then in vivo or in the body, right? What does it do mechanistically to help treat, right, the cancers that we're using it for? So starting out from like the lab perspective, what has to happen for CAR T cell therapy to arrive at the patient's bedside? Like what's that process from like the T cell, I guess, you could tell us where we go from there and until, you know, we infuse it.
Yeah, sure. I'll talk a little bit about like how we get it from the patient, how it's altered, how it's brought back to the patient, and then a little bit about, you know, the different types of CAR Ts that we're potentially initiating in these patients. But in general, it all starts about identifying the perfect patient that can qualify for CAR T cell therapy, which is usually your relapse refractory types of heme malignancy patients. But this all starts with an apheresis nurse helping out with T-cell collection. So it's a leukapheresis process. The T-cells are separated through centrifugation, and then the rest of the blood is returned to the patient. Those T-cells are then sent off to the lab to be actually genetically engineered to express this CAR gene or chimeric antigen receptor. And that's via introduction of an inactive virus that is actually used to insert genes into the T-cell. These genes actually allow the CARs to come to the surface of the T-cells. And then after they do that, they actually stay in the lab for further expansion of these CAR expressing T cells ex vivo over the next few days. They're then shipped back to the hospital, and then they're given at the bedside, infused back into the patient after conditioning chemotherapy, which makes space for the engineered T cells to grow and attack other cancer cells. And then CAR T cells travel to the sites of cancer and begin to recognize and attack cancer cells, which allow them to express the target protein recognized by the CAR. It's actually funny though, because, you know, this is such a treatment of cure for a lot of patients. And, you know, you think it would come in, you know, fancy bag or something, but really it's just, it looks like another, you know, pack of red blood cells, but it's a pack of CAR T cells, and it's $1 million, but it's, you know, it's a curative process for them. And it's amazing how simple it actually looks like when it gets to the bedside. But there's actually,
hold on a second, Matt, cause you read my mind in talking about, so it looks like a thing of packed red blood cells. Like that's what it, cause I envisioned FFP when I was thinking of it. So it looks like blood essentially.
Yeah, it's like a diluted like red color that it comes to at the bedside. But yeah, it really doesn't look as expensive as it is.
Okay, I interrupted. I had to clarify. So go ahead.
You're good. But yeah, these CAR T cells, there's two main types of CAR T cell therapy modalities, and these are CD19 or BCMA targeted CAR T cells. And unlike conventional effector T cells, CAR T cells can actually recognize antigens irrespective of MHC presentation, and nevertheless being limited to the recognition of surface expressed structures. After binding of the CAR T cells, the cells actually mediate their antitumoral effects through a perforin and granzyme axis to cause this lysis of antigen-positive tumor cells. And more specifically, CD19-targeted therapies, they're the most widely used type of CAR T-cell therapy and are designed to target CD19, which is a protein that's actually expressed on the surface of certain types of cancer cells, which mainly include B-cell lymphomas and leukemias. And these approved therapies, there's four of them, and get ready for the names. So one of the brand names is Kymriah with the generic Tisagenlecel, and then Yescarta is the second one, which is axicabtagene filolacil or Axicel. There's Tecartus, which is brexicabtagene autolucil, and then lastly Breyanzi, which is lysocabtagene maralucil. I know that's a mouthful. And then lastly, the second type is the BCMA-targeted CAR T-cell therapies, which is designed to target C-cell maturation antigens expressed specifically on multiple myeloma cells. The two products that are available there are Abecma, which is idecabtagene viclucil, and Carvykti, which is ciltacabtagene autolucil.
Wow, that was amazing. Okay, we have to ask.
I had to practice that.
What's your favorite, not based on anything, but name alone out of those? And you can choose whether it's brand or generic name, whichever one you choose.
Yeah, it's definitely the one that we use the most commonly, which is Yescarta. And it's only because I can say it without having to look at the name and pronounce each syllable and not have to worry about being wrong when I'm pronouncing it. But yeah, Axicabtagene Solosyl. It's the only one that really rolls off the tongue compared to the rest of them.
I agree. My vote is the exact opposite. As somebody who doesn't have to say it, I picked the longest one, right, which is Lysocabtagene Marilucyl. And I had to YouTube that a few times. How'd I do pronunciation-wise?
Good. I'm glad you practiced.
I love that lysos. They even shorten it to just lysocell. So the fact that it's so long, You shorten the generic name. Never heard of that before. So we have a much larger use varieties of indications, much more available products. So obviously these are going to be used more. There's some, you know, benefits that I was reading, right, that it's, you know, just an easier infusion. You're not coming back every single day for weeks or once a week for 3 to 4, all that kind of stuff. So we're going to see this more. And if things go well, right, we're not seeing these patients in the ICU, right? They might be monitoring, but you know, they're going to go without necessarily seeing us. Now, they transfer to that ICU when adverse effects occur. So are there standard labs or medications that these patients will commonly get after like an immune-related adverse effect from this CAR T-cell treatment? Or is it really individualized because the symptoms can be so wide in a variety of them?
Yeah. You know, we typically only see these patients when toxicities are more severe, specifically talking about us as critical care pharmacists when they come to the ICU. You know, in the post-CAR T-cell infusion period, we are doing a lot of standard labs, you know, your general CBC, CMP, coagulation panel, but also some inflammatory labs such as CRP and serum ferritin. And you know, usually CRP actually normalizes before the onset of ICANS. It's something we also actually look at. But specifically looking at, you know, what are bringing these patients to the ICU, what sort of things we also look at. And specifically when we're looking at cytokine release syndrome or CRS, we'll run also infectious workups if not recently performed, such as blood and urine cultures, as well as a chest x-ray. If they haven't obtained one, we'll also get an echo at this time. Things such as like standard medications and other interventions that, you know, are included once they reach the ICU, if not before, are things for fever specifically. So like Tylenol or ibuprofen, if it's not broken with Tylenol. Broad spectrum antibiotics are another big one, plus or minus G-CSF, if the patient is continuously neutropenic as well. And then also fluid boluses as needed for hypotension on top of having CRS, vasopressors as needed once they hit the ICU. And if not already on seizure prophylaxis, they typically are started on seizure prophylaxis with Keppra somewhere between 500 to 750 twice a day. And then lastly, also for fever, they typically have a hypothermia blanket as well available as well. And we'll get more into this as we continue on, but obviously our anti-immune effector cell therapies come into play here as well, which include tocilizumab, steroids, and anakinra as well, depending on grading and treatment response. And then as far as ICANS go, typically with ICANS, we will get brain imaging as well. So MRI, but CT if MRI is not feasible, stat EEG, a lumbar diagnostic lumbar puncture, other causes of, you know, encephalopathy are suspected. And within that lumbar puncture, we're running a meningitis encephalitis panel from the CSF if symptoms persist despite ICANS interventions that we've made. Some other standard medications that we usually do for ICANS patients include seizure prophylaxis for at least 30 days after their CAR T-cell therapies, even if EEG continues to be negative. And then again, our anti-immune effector cell therapies, such as the mainstay of steroids, tocilizumab, as well as anakinra.
That is just as lot and complicated as I expected it to be. Mm-hmm. And when you look through those guidelines, It can hit every single organ system, right? So it makes sense that you're going to do all those specific things and really rule out stuff, right? You're starting antibiotics in case this is a, you know, they in septic shock, right? Which can present fever, hypotension, you know, probably similarly. So that kind of makes sense from just a supportive care kind of perspective. You know, one question that, you know, you talked about how these drugs work and their targets. And a lot of times if you look in guidelines or even review papers, you'll see biomarkers and labs, like ordering IL-6 and things like that. So how essential are they? Like, I know they could probably be helpful, but I know most places, those specific kind of, they don't run in-house, right? You're getting them back in a couple of days. So how essential are like those kind of biomarkers to identification and stuff in the treatment of these patients?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I know that we started, the vast majority of the IC population started thinking more about IL-6, especially with the onset of COVID and using tocilizumab in those patients. But as far as biomarkers go for CAR T-cell patients, we still treat CRS and ICANS generally the same without biomarkers in general. We can draw IL-6 levels, but we know intuitively that they will be high, specifically relate because we know they'll be high based on the pathophysiology in general. And hence why our treatments are largely centered around scoring systems that include signs, symptoms, as well as diagnostic findings from the patients. I will say, though, that I'm not an expert in all the biomarkers associated with CRS and ICANS, and that at least at MD Anderson, I know that they are drawn definitely for research purposes. Although we do technically, we can run IL-6 levels in-house at MD Anderson. They do take up to 24 to 48 hours to return. But in that time, your patient may have very well have already progressed multiple grades of CRS or ICANS. So from my perspective, I don't see that they really add a whole lot to the treatment plan when in reality, when they hit the ICU, your treatment plan is, you know, minutes to hours to days that you're needing effective therapies in place.
Yeah, they come in, it's full court press. Lumbar punctures on the standard cocktail coming in, right? That's definitely the VIP treatment. And that's a good point about research. I didn't think about that, where a lot of these centers are probably doing research, so they may be getting labs from that perspective. That's a really good thing. I'm glad you pointed that out. So let's move into those adverse effects that will bring them to the ICU. And cytokine release syndrome, or CRS, is this the most common adverse effect that you see in these patients, or is this the one that just gets the most publicity?
Yeah, I think that's another good question, as I think it's important to both highlight how often CRS actually does occur, but also that other adverse drug events are also possible in this post-CAR T-cell infusion time period. But I'd say by and large, CRS is definitely the most common severe adverse drug event that can occur. In all of the large landmark trials from the 6 approved CAR T cell products, the rate of any CRS reaction ranges anywhere from 40 up to 95% of the time that they'll develop it. With grade 3 reactions, which is typically, you know, your ICU admission reason, making up to 25% in those patients, but it can occur from 1% all the way up to 25% in those trials. It's definitely ranging. And although there are a host of other immune-related adverse events that can occur, including immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, aka ICANS, immune effector cell-associated hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis-like syndrome, otherwise known as secondary HLH, prolonged cytopenias and infection, as well as hypogammaglobulinemia. But I would say in general I know that's a mouthful as well, but I know from an ICU standpoint, CRS is definitely the one that we're definitely intervening the most on in these patients.
So why is there such a variance in, like you mentioned, that it could be anywhere from mid 40% to mid 90%, right? So why is there such variation with presentation, timing? You mentioned like the grade 3s and 4s and severity with CRS. Like, is that related to just the immunotherapy in general, or is this specific to the CAR T cell therapy?
Yeah, and that's the tricky part with CAR T toxicity surveillance. You know, although we have a pretty good idea of when and how these immune-related adverse events, including cytokine release syndrome, will occur, it's not an exact science. You know, unlike, you know, our traditional chemotherapy-associated side effects, which can be nonspecific and cause permanent damage, you know, many CAR T-mediated toxicities are on target and reverse when CAR T cells are done expanding, eradicated, or exhausted. You know, when CAR T cells are infused, they engage with their designated antigens on cancer cells, and this activation leads to this further proliferation of CAR T cells and release of this massive amount of cytokines and chemokines, you know, which include your IL-6, IL-2, IFN-gamma, GM-CSF. from these antigen-directed T cells, which can cause this massive CRS pathway. However, there are certain characteristics that can predict, you know, severe CRS so that we know which patients we're worried about, which ones we need to monitor more closely, which ones are likely going to make their way to the ICU. And these include patients who are at baseline, have higher tumor burden, have thrombocytopenia before their lymphodepletion, or they have lymphodepletion using specifically cyclophosphamide and fludarabine-based regimens, and also patients who have high baseline inflammatory markers such as ferritin.
So, you know, you mentioned that, especially even when they come into the ICU, a lot of what's happening is supportive care with some of those things. You're trying to bring the fever down. If they're really hypotensive, obviously fluid suppressors, if they need to bring blood pressure up. At what point, maybe you could start with what grade or however you want to describe it, but when do we start to get into our MAB treatments? When do we really get into the hemonc side of things? Is it when they come to the ICU? Earlier, later, what's the kind of guidance from that perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's important to start with like, what is the grading of CRS so that we can kind of identify like what treatments are appropriate within those.
Great point.
And so per at least the American Society of Transplantation and Cellular Therapy or the ASTCT, the grading for CRS is grades 1 through 4. And it's basically largely based on 3 different symptoms or signs. Grade 1 is fever is present. Grade 2 is that you have a fever and hypotension is present but not requiring vasopressors, and or you have hypoxia and you're requiring some oxygen supplementation with nasal cannula. Grade 3, you have fever present. Hypotension is also present and you are requiring at least one vasopressor, and or you may have hypoxia requiring additional oxygen supplementation with things such as high flow nasal cannula or non-rebreather. And then lastly, the most severe grade being grade 4, you have fever present, you have hypotension present requiring multiple pressors, usually at least 2 to 3 pressors on top of vasopressin. And you can have hypoxia requiring positive pressure ventilation. Specifically, at MD Anderson, we currently consider tocilizumab therapy when they've already met grade 1. Grade 1 cytokine release syndrome if fever persists for at least 3 days or for at least 24 hours in these high-risk patients that had initial high tumor burden or high baseline inflammatory markers. But when we get to that grade 2 through 4, this is when we definitely should be giving tocilizumab, and it can be given actually up to every 8 hours for up to 3 doses in a 24-hour period.
So, question about the fever kind of diagnosis or requirement. You said for 72 hours. Do they need to be on antibiotics, or is it just no matter what, if they have, obviously they're probably getting those started anyways, but is it just being febrile for 72 hours and that's it? Or is there any other criteria behind that?
Yeah, in general, these patients are already going to be on broad spectrum antibiotics, given the fever, given the likely neutropenia as well. But in general, like fever itself is a criteria alone for a specific time period in our grading system.
And when you mention tocilizumab specifically, I think, you know, I'm familiar with doing a fixed dose approach for other indications. When we're using it for treatment in this perspective, should we be doing that, or should we go into that more traditional weight-based dosing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually haven't thought about this in a while whenever I was looking it up. We actually still use weight-based dosing. So the guidelines suggest this, and we also use this, but it's an 8 mg per kg dosing with a max of 800 milligrams for tocilizumab. I know there's been some studies have looked at fixed dose versus weight-based dosing. I don't think there's truly a difference that's known yet, but in general, all the standardized dosing schemes utilize weight-based dosing still.
Yeah, I like to point that out because it's different for, you know, I'm kind of used to seeing the difference. And like you said, that's what all the guidelines state. And it makes sense based on just how it works that you would probably, you don't want to shortchange it, right? You don't want to give low and then have to just delay what potentially the inevitable. So the other thing that you mentioned talking about treatments is corticosteroids. Is there any detriment or interaction between the CAR T cells with corticosteroids, thinking more probably in terms of reducing the efficacy of that T cell treatment?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I, when I first moved to MD Anderson, had the thought of, like, you know, what is the reason for giving steroids in these patients? Does it actually hurt our CAR T cell therapy? Because obviously we know steroids can be lymphocytic, and we know that we're giving these engineered T cells, which function as our lymph tissue, right? But I will say that after being there, I've learned that corticosteroids do play an important role in our cytokine release syndrome management as well. As you can imagine, the use of steroids may alleviate certain CRS symptoms, but there's still a theoretical concern that you do, at higher doses, you can suppress the CAR T cell expansion and persistence, which would in theory limit anti-tumor benefit from CAR T cells. But fortunately, this concern hasn't been supported by most studies, particularly with short courses of steroids, which we're typically doing with CRS. Our corticosteroid use is pretty on par with the guideline recommendations, starting with grade 2. We typically recommend dexamethasone starting at 4 to 10 milligrams IV times at least one dose, or methylprednisolone equivalent. And typically in grade 2, if you're reaching for a second dose of tocilizumab at this point, you should be thinking about a dose of steroids as well after no initial response, and that's definitely reasonable. Once you hit grade 3 CRS, we're typically scheduling dexamethasone at usually 10 milligrams every 6 hours. However, if we're in a situation where, you know, you're on multiple pressors, you're in a hypoxic status, requiring intubation, within 24 hours of starting, the steroids will typically double them to at least 20 milligrams every 6 hours, and thinking about other interventions as well, as we mentioned. However, once we hit the grade 4, we typically are switching up to at least pulse dose steroids with methylpred, usually at least a gram IV daily times 3 days, and then a longer taper with those patients.
Those are big boy steroid doses. Those are no joke. I like that you pointed out too that if symptoms persist, that tocilizumab dose is repeated. It's not a one time where you're assessing in 24, 48 hours. Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt. What I'm seeing is you can do max of 3 doses every 8 hours times 3. So you're repeating that if things don't get better, which is something I like to highlight, just because this is just kind of different than we normally use it, at least those of us in the non kind of hemonc ICU side.
Yep, correct. You're correct about that. Up to 3 doses.
Any other notable last line treatments to kind of briefly highlight? I think we kind of hit probably 2 of the main players, but if maybe those don't work or you need alternative ideas for one thing or another, is there anything of note after those 2?
Yeah, there's a couple things to mention. I think sort of our last sort of mainstay of treatment that's kind of worked its way to the guidelines in the last 2 to 3 years, anakinra, which is an IL-1 receptor antagonist. This was a new addition to at least the NCCN guidelines with the December 2023 update. And the rationale for targeting IL-1 specifically is based on evidence from 2 preclinical studies, both which demonstrated that IL-1 blockade protected against cytokine release syndrome in at least mouse models without impacting the anti-tumor effect of CAR T cells. Now, currently, the guideline recommendation is based on limited data, but ongoing clinical trials will continue to help shed light on whether anakinra is a reasonable alternative to tocilizumab for CRS. So at Anderson, at least, we'll consider anakinra in grades 2 to 4 cytokine release syndrome for those that are refractory to initial anti-IL-6 therapy or tocilizumab, as well as corticosteroids. For example, ongoing grade 2 to 4 CRS for at least 6 hours after initiation of steroids, and it's typically dosed 100 milligrams every 12 hours times 7 days. Obviously, some other options that come up are CRT as a last line option to help clear additional inflammatory proteins. And other options that I won't get too far into the weeds on include things like ruxolitinib, which is a JAK1/2 inhibitor, cyclophosphamide, IVIG, as well as ATG or antithymocyte globulin. You know, there's also something that I recently learned about, which are the safety switches within specific CAR T cell products. You know, safety switches are essentially inducible suicide genes that are encoded within the CAR product themselves that can be targeted and activated by specific medications. For instance, remiducid for caspase 9 or cetuximab or rituximab for EGFR. And we would reserve these for use only when we need to eradicate the CAR T cells in the setting of severe refractory life-threatening CAR T cell mediated toxicities. So keep in mind, this does render your anti-tumor effect completely ineffective, but these are definitely reserved for those life-threatening toxicities where it does become necessary to use them.
That may be the coolest drug feature that I have ever heard of. It's like James Bond. That's the 007 in a medication, essentially. Wow, that's, man, technology is unbelievable. That's wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely effective, but obviously you're unfortunately getting rid of, you know, almost $1 million of products with one medication. So, you know, it definitely does has its downsides, but obviously, like, death is definitely worse.
Yeah, you're safe. Right? That's so. Exactly right. What's going to kill immediately. And that's the only reason you would do that, essentially. Right. Exactly. So let's move into kind of the other biggest or most notable side effect that you'll see if you're kind of going through some of the literature with this, which is immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICANS. Quick aside, I love, they know how complicated their words and acronyms are, because there are such great acronyms throughout all of this. So, but when we're talking about like CRS and ICANS, is there a relationship at all? Is there like a mechanism that can explain why these things can occur simultaneously?
Yeah, that's a good question. And they commonly do, you know, happen simultaneously. But I do want to first point out, at least for the listeners, that ICANS, like you mentioned, immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, was previously known as CAR T cell-related encephalopathy syndrome, or CRES, which is actually what I learned as first whenever it first came out, for those that might be unfamiliar. And the pathogenesis specifically of ICANS is less clear than cytokine release syndrome. But similar to cytokine release syndrome, ICANS typically does occurs in situations in which higher peak in vivo CAR T cell numbers develop, whether that's from higher infused cell dose or higher pretreatment bone marrow disease burden or other factors that lead to greater in vivo T cell expansion, such as fludarabine containing preconditioning regimens. But I would say in general, more patients will have some degree of CRS after CAR T cell infusion, up to 42 to 95% compared to ICANS of any grade, which is somewhere between 10 to 65% when you look at all the landmark trials that allowed FDA approval of all the CAR T products. But usually patients do develop ICANS, will have had CRS previously or concurrently. So most patients will develop CRS and may or may not get ICANS, but if ICANS does occur, it's likely that they had or have ongoing CRS as well. CRS normally presents in the first week after CAR T cell infusion, and ICANS usually within that 7 to 14 day window after CAR T cell infusion, so a little bit later than CRS, obviously. And in ICANS, there's a theoretical similar start to CRS. You have pro-inflammatory cytokines by CAR T cells that are generated in the tumor microenvironment. So you have IL-1, IL-6, IL-10, IFN gamma, and I could go on and on and on, but those are the mainstays of cytokines, which then diffuse into the bloodstream and eventually can cause this disruption syndrome in the blood-brain barrier, with accumulation of both cytokines as well as the CAR T cells in the CNS, which contributes to this overall encephalopathy syndrome that you see.
So if, like, because when I was looking into things, you know, I'd find some articles that said, you know, nervous system toxicity, for example. Are those just older articles, or they're just using kind of an old or outdated term, essentially?
Yeah, this is a more complex sort of thing, because obviously nervous system toxicity is an umbrella term, right? Kind of similar to your immunosuppression when we talked about that. So the umbrella term encompasses multiple different things. ICANS is a specific type of neurological toxicity that's marked by depressed level of consciousness, potential seizures, possible focal motor weakness in more severe cases, and potential for elevated intracranial pressures, cerebral edema in advanced cases. ICANS is also very specific to CAR T cell toxicity as compared to the types of nervous system toxicities you can see with other types of immune checkpoint inhibitors. But I will say, though, in the less severe types of toxicities, patients after CAR T cell can also experience some less severe nervous system side effects, such as headache, confusion, and dizziness, which can also play into the different types of nervous system toxicities you can see. I did also want to mention, though, that, you know, we're most familiar probably with ICANS as far as an ICU requiring condition from a toxic standpoint. But there's another emerging nervous system toxicity that can also occur with CAR T cells. And this phenomenon is called movement and neurocognitive treatment emergent adverse events, or MNTs, another acronym for us, that can also occur in patients who have received anti-BCMA CAR T cell therapy, such as Carvykti or Abecma. One of the ones we use for, and these are the ones we use for multiple myeloma. These patients are at highest risk for developing MNTs if they have a higher tumor burden or high baseline inflammatory markers, have had grade 2 or higher CRS or any ICANS at any point, high CAR T cell expansion. And these MNTs are different from ICANS in that they occur actually months up to a year after CAR T cell therapy. So, you know, usually with CRS and ICANS, we're seeing these patients during their hospitalization for their CAR T cell infusion versus these MNTs, they may have already been discharged and coming back with new neurosymptoms. So a little bit different from a, you know, onset of events and also management of an event. The condition can actually be described by movement disorders such as tremors, cogwheel rigidity, dyskinesia, can also affect personality changes and cognitive impairment, but also nerve changes such as difficulty swallowing, double vision, as well as facial droop.
Can really encompass a wide variety of things. It's got to be challenging sometimes to truly narrow down which it is, because it, you know, when you describe the wide range of symptoms that also mimic other common disease states, I'm guessing that kind of creates a little bit of a challenge for the treatment team.
Yeah, I'll definitely say, like, we're still learning, right? So, like, a lot of our CAR T-cell therapies were starting to be infused in patients in, you know, the 2015 through 2018. So now we're finally getting some, you know, longer-term data that describes, you know, events that happen to patients over a year time frame. So I'm sure as more of that data comes out, we'll have more identification of what long-term toxic effects we can have as well.
And I like the way that you kind of described, if you have CRS, it doesn't mean you're guaranteed to have ICANS. But if you have ICANS, it's likely that you had CRS. That's a good way. Yeah. That's going to stick. I like that. I think that's going to help the listeners too. This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. That's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. You know, talking about these can occur at the same time, potentially from the same treatment, right? So CRS has its own kind of grading scale. Does ICANS have a similar one? Do they have similar presentations, or are they kind of completely different mechanistic or in terms of like the monitoring, grading, treatment, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, both CRS and ICANS both have grades 1 through 4, but how we look at those grades is a little bit different. It's important to keep in mind that CAR T cell therapy is a cellular therapy given once, and these toxicities are expected to develop. But for this reason, any hospital with CAR T program should be well equipped for monitoring, diagnosing, and treating ADEs that arise, both on the floor as well as in the ICU. Something different, though, from cytokine release syndrome is that with ICANS, as we monitor an ICE score, which is an immune effector cell encephalopathy score. The score encompasses about 5 different domains, which look at orientation, naming, following commands, writing, and attention, with the score ranging from 0 to 9. The higher the score, the less the encephalopathy. Grading of ICANS is based on the ICE score, but also level of consciousness, seizures, seizure findings, motor findings, as well as findings of elevated ICP or cerebral edema. Patients are typically monitored on the floor in grades 1 to 2 ICANS, which corresponds to an ICE score of anywhere between 3 and 9. And patients will come to the ICU once they hit grade 3, which is usually hallmarked by some seizure event, plus an ICE score usually ranging from 0 to 2. And then grade 4 would be marked by a more prolonged seizure event. So seizures lasting longer than 5 minutes, unarousable status, diffuse cerebral edema on imaging, or deep vocal motor weakness. Unlike cytokine release syndrome, though, steroids typically are a mainstay of therapy here. We're typically starting dexamethasone or methylprednisolone equivalent in grade one. And typically the reason for dexamethasone is just that difference in blood-brain barrier penetration with dexamethasone. However, if concurrent cytokine release syndrome is happening, we'll also start tocilizumab with similar dosing to how we described previously. From grades 2 to 4, we'll also consider anakinra in these patients who are steroid refractory, which is actually a little bit of a slight deviation from the guidelines. The decision to include anakinra for treatment in grade 2 as opposed to grade 3, which is how it is in the guidelines, which is actually based on our own internal data from an ongoing study that shows a reduction in length and severity of ICANS. It's expected that the ASTCT will actually incorporate these in the guidelines once they're published. But once we're in grade 3, we will double our steroid dosing once encephalopathy is not improving for at least 24 hours. I should also mention that a recent phase one study published in ASH last year also looked at the prophylactic use of anakinra to mitigate ICANS and B-cell lymphoma patients who got Yescarta. It's a little bit different, right? So prophylactic meaning like they started it even before they got the cells compared to getting it grade 2, grade 3, which is what we're currently doing. So in this prophylactic study, 20 patients received anakinra 100 milligrams daily or 100 milligrams twice daily times 7 days, starting 6 hours before their CAR T-cell infusion. And they specifically looked at safety and tolerability of anakinra after infusion, looking at CRS as well as ICANS rates. CRS was observed in any grade up to 95% in patients, but grade 3 and 4 only 5%, while ICANS was observed up to 35%, but grades 3 and 4 and 20% of them. They demonstrated that prophylactic anakinra can be safely administered in these large B-cell lymphoma patients with the Yescarta, but they had no apparent difference in incidence, grade, or duration of CRS or ICANS. So despite this being, you know, a small sample size, anakinra does show a favorable safety profile while maintaining the efficacy of Yescarta cells to a similar level of the Zuma 1 trial. I think further larger studies are warranted to confirm the ability to prophylax with anakinra to mitigate ICANS, but this study doesn't show that we should be doing it prophylactically, maybe in the future with larger trials, but for now we're limiting it specifically to grade 2 at MD Anderson per the guidelines starting at grade 3.
It makes sense that you know, unfortunately, right, you definitely, if it showed evidence of some benefit, you would use it. But in the era of drug shortages, right, you can't just be giving it out when there's people that could be truly experiencing them and actually may need, you know, the treatment, and then there's none left. Then we get cost, all those things. That makes complete sense.
Not to mention drug cost, yeah.
Yeah. So not only, you know, you mentioned that the, you know, the grade 3 can be classified by having a seizure when they come into the ICU, or even afterwards they're getting seizure prophylaxis. So say they come in and are in, you know, status epilepticus, for example, or even they just have multiple seizures. Like, are you truly treating those seizures with anti-epileptic drugs, or is this more like alcohol withdrawal where that's a symptom of something different and you need to get the tocilizumab, get the steroids, maybe anakinra, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, right? So with seizure or status epilepticus events in the post-CAR T-cell infusion period, as well as patients who develop cerebral edema or ICP elevations, typically we're treating them based on local institution practices, as guidelines don't give specific recommendations outside of the seizure prophylaxis for 30 days post the CAR T-cell infusion. I'd say in general, though, yes, we will treat the disease state, but also focus on fixing the etiologies via using steroids, anakinra, tocilizumab, et cetera. But generally, we'll follow the typical status epilepticus pathway. However, starting with Keprez, or at MD Anderson, starting with Keprez, our first second-line agent after our abortive therapy with benzodiazepines. Although some centers, I have heard, are starting with valproic acid or phenytoin based on their practice, as a second-line agent, I should say. I'll also note that starting in grade 1 ICANS, we're routinely obtaining EEG as well as a neurology consult in order to rule out our non-convulsive status epilepticus events. There's a recent actual retrospective study that was published in Blood Cancer Journal in 2022 that looked at patients who received Yescarta. And of the 33 patients reviewed, 13 of those had video EEG, and all 12 out of 13 patients had abnormal EEG findings, with the majority finding non-convulsive status epilepticus. It's suspected, obviously, that the actual rate of non-convulsive status is likely underreported due to difficulties in the diagnosis and identification. But as many listeners are probably well aware, the diagnosis of non-convulsive status is definitely challenging. EEG is required to establish this diagnosis because the encephalopathic symptoms like coma or mental confusion in critically ill patients doesn't by themselves distinguish patients with non-convulsive status from those without. And for this very reason, we start monitoring EEG super early in the ICANS trajectory.
So you had mentioned earlier HLH as an adverse event. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it after you smashed a grand slam with that. But any other lesser known adverse effects that you want to give some love to, or things that we might see, you know, come to they might experience these come to our ICU?
Yeah, really the only one I wanted to touch on was really secondary HLH, like you talked about, because there is a little bit on treatment for it specifically, if you don't mind me talking about it. But similar to classical HLH, which we've all probably seen at least once in the ICU, the ASTCT guidelines actually recently published guidance on diagnosing and treating this phenomenon in a paper this past July. Accordingly, it's hypothesized that immune effector cells like CAR T cells can become activated by tumor antigens, but also subsequently transactivate macrophages, which we know are implicated in the HLH pathway, and lead to concurrent CAR T and macrophage activation and cytokine release. The new grading scale encompasses clinical parameters such as fever, hypotension, and hypoxia, similar to our cytokine release syndrome grading, but it's noted for being clinically independent from CRS as compared to ICANS, where we know that CRS usually happens before ICANS. HLH is usually clinically independent from CRS. Diagnosis is based on the features of macrophage activation, known recent immune effector cell therapy, known hyperfibrinogenemia. Therapy is consistent usually of anakinra plus or minus steroids. We can also use ruxolitinib with etoposide and also emapalumab as our last line options as well.
So we've been focusing our discussion on CAR T cell therapy and its specific adverse events kind of so up to this point. Let's kind of shift gears a little bit into what I think is another class that is becoming, the use is becoming more common. Adverse events from them are also secondary to that becoming more common. So thinking specifically of our immune checkpoint inhibitors, How is the mechanism of this specific class different from our CAR T cell therapy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it definitely comes up a lot. I think that something to keep in mind is that the overall goal effect is the same, which is immunomodulation to help our immune system fight off these bad cancer cells. But how we do it is a little bit different. As many are probably aware, immune checkpoints are cell surface proteins expressed on T cells and can generally have enhanced stimulatory or inhibitory signals after identification of appropriate ligands. You know, cancer cells have masking protein receptors that can actually trick our T cells into leaving them alone. Immune checkpoint inhibitors are typically these monoclonal antibodies that work, you know, for the most part at PD-1, PD-L1, or CTLA-4 by neutralizing these masking protein receptors. They block these checkpoint proteins from binding to the partner proteins and prevent the off signal from being sent, allowing for these T cells to continue killing cancer cells without having turning them off. I'll say on the flip side, though, each CAR T cell is engineered to target a specific kind of cancer antigen expressed on tumor cells and not healthy cells. And once they're targeted, the CAR T cells can multiply and signal other parts of the immune system to come to the site of tumor killing as well. So in general, like I said, immunomodulation is overall the same between the two agents, but how they get there, immune checkpoint inhibitors make this happen indirectly as compared to CAR T cells, which are able to directly cause this anti-tumoral effect.
So obviously ramping up our T cells and immune system is going to cause some problems, but do we see the same adverse events like cytokine release syndrome or ICANS like we do from CAR T cell treatment?
Yeah, as with anything good, there's always a catch, right? And yes, although we avoid classical toxicity seen with traditional care chemotherapy, we still have immune-related adverse events that occur with immune checkpoint inhibitors as a cause of ramping up our own immune system. Immune checkpoint inhibitors essentially allow us to take the brakes off the immune system, which helps wake up our immune system to fight cancer cells. You know, but it also interferes with homeostasis, which can lead to off-target toxicities that we commonly see, both, you know, in the general wards of the hospital, but also when they get more severe in the ICU. And these classes of medications include our CTLA-4 and PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors. And just in general, these two different receptors, CTLA-4, PD-1, have very different roles in immune regulation. CTLA-4 mediated immune checkpoint is involved in antigen presentation phase prior to T cells being even exposed to an antigen or targeted toward a particular tissue. Medications like ipilimumab, also known as Yervoy, are your types of CTLA-4 inhibitors, and they prevent T cells from binding with their partner proteins that may prevent them from doing their job of attacking cancer cells. It functions as a signal dampener to maintain a consistent level of T-cell activation. And more specifically, these CTLA-4 inhibitors reduce the activation of naive T-cells and may also interfere with ongoing stimulation of T-cells in inflamed tissues. So by inhibiting CTLA-4 with our monoclonal antibodies, we actually allow for amplification of T-cells prior to antigen targeting, and hence why this class, as compared to PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors, has more potential for toxicity. I'll say on the flip side, though, PD-1 regulates inflammatory responses in the tissues, and hence why activated T cells will upregulate PD-1 through inflammation. Examples of these medications that target PD-1 include nivolumab or Opdivo, and also pembrolizumab, also known as Keytruda. I will say, although we don't get CRS or ICANS with immune checkpoint inhibitors, we do get toxicities that affect primarily the skin, the GI system, the lungs, liver, the CNS, specifically the pituitary gland, among a few others.
I love that you said it just primarily affects, and then I think you named every organ system, like you were a pharmacy student presenting right on their first patient. But yeah, but like when you look at it, it literally does describe all of those. So are you when they come into the ICU with the adverse event from these immune checkpoint inhibitors, is it obvious as to the organ system that's involved, or is it you have 8 people doing a workup of every organ system that could cause problems, and a lot of them being, like you said, inflammation, right? A lot of them being itis issues affecting almost everything.
Yeah, I think this is definitely the tricky part, and when being a clinician at the bedside becomes challenging because there's a lot of things to consider in these patients. I think for me, working at a place like MD Anderson where all of our patients have cancer, it's always in our differential diagnosis, but I can see definitely when you're not working at a cancer hospital how challenging it might be to identify this as the primary culprit. Additionally, I'll say we have some tools that can help us zero in on identifying whether the presenting organ system failure is related to immune checkpoint inhibitor exposure. We have a general idea of the time course from exposure to likelihood of toxicity that we can easily backtrack in our system to be able to tell when a patient had received their last immune checkpoint inhibitors to forward track to see, is this within the time frame for this specific toxicity for them to develop this type of toxicity? Say, for example, the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors, the time of onset of specifically pneumonitis is much more delayed than a lot of the other organ toxicities, with some grade of pneumonitis expected within 3 to 4 months, but sometimes extending almost up to 9 to 10 months since the last exposure. Your differential diagnosis is usually something like pneumonia, pleural effusion, pulmonary edema, worsening metastatic disease, and maybe pneumonitis, but you know, if they have a history of immune checkpoint inhibitor administration, it should definitely be on your differential. So I think obviously this is where a detailed patient history and diagnostics come into play and can make a huge difference in diagnosing and treatment, as they are very different, right? You know, if we're thinking it's a pneumonia, we're thinking antimicrobials, we're thinking pneumonitis, then we're thinking more steroids. So obviously our treatments are vastly different, and very important being able to identify what your etiology is coming from. I think for this reason, though, that's why a lot of times when patients are started on immune checkpoint inhibitors, their baseline is documented from a symptom standpoint. So for instance, like someone started on nivolumab or pembrolizumab, who have baseline pulmonary issues, their baseline oxygen use is documented, whether they use an inhaler is documented, and they're also given a 6-minute walk test to see where they're at baseline before they're exposed to any of these immune checkpoint inhibitors. And all these are crucial in knowing whether these new symptoms are a change from baseline, and patients are actually educated as well at baseline to know whether they're having any changes from their baseline pulmonary symptoms and to explicitly let anyone know and report any changes that they notice. Again, this is just one example of using pneumonitis, but the same could be true for other types of toxicities that are the most common, such as cutaneous or skin, GI system, liver, as well as CNS and pituitary.
I mean, what you're describing is why this is so challenging. The fact that that literally needs to be in your differential months and months. And I know in your, because it you see and treat these patients so much, it is. I'm just telling you, I don't know if that's necessarily the case in hospitals that don't do this. You know, our sister hospital does, so we'll get some of these coming in. So we're a little, but I'm thinking, right, if you're not, and even if you, you know, I think sometimes you get the history, and that's where knowing what some of the things do matter. Cause some people just see a MAB, right, or something, and it's like, oh, we can hold that or whatnot, and that kind of thing. So that's a really good point. Also probably highlights why this care is so challenging when with these patients.
I even catch myself sometimes having worked there, you know, almost 2 years now, thinking like not thinking about immune checkpoint inhibitor toxicity when they come in with these different organ failures. And now I'm trying to get trained into a point where I'm always thinking about them. But, you know, I definitely get it from not working at MD Anderson, how difficult it can be to identify and diagnose these as well.
So I have to ask, because in one of the guidelines, as we're looking at these toxicities, it says to quote, to minimize the occurrence of steroid-induced adverse events, the lowest effective corticosteroid dose should be prescribed for the shortest possible duration. So translate that, Matt, into what that means in the hem-onc world. Is that that feels like a guidance. A suggestion.
Yeah, definitely a guidance. I would say like short is a stretch, because it's usually a longer period of time that they're on steroids. But I will say each toxicity, like ICANS and CRS, has a grade. It's usually grades 1 to 4. But generally, these treatments are recommended to hold the current immunotherapy and give steroids to mitigate some of the negative toxicities from the immune checkpoint inhibitor. They generally, once symptoms start, for instance, shortness of breath with pneumonitis, we are holding immunotherapy and we're starting outpatient prednisone, for instance, or equivalent doses of at least 1 mg/kg/day. So it's not small doses by any means, and tapering over at least 4 weeks once resolved. So once they get down to grade 1 symptoms, they're still tapering it over a month almost at that point. And with more severe symptoms that require hospitalization, you'll see even higher doses of methylprednisolone alone, up to 2 mg/kg/day. Again, tapered over 4 weeks once they go down all the way to grade 1 symptoms. So it's definitely a prolonged period of time, but I think that guidance of lowest steroid for the lowest amount of time is just trying to keep you from them being on it for, you know, months and months and months, but trying to have an idea of having a taper in mind or having an end goal in mind, I think, is what's important. So yes, even though these are our starting doses, therapy can be tailored to symptoms. And given their already heightened risk for infection, hyperglycemic, adverse drug events, we, especially as pharmacists, try to wean steroids as much as possible to meet patient symptoms.
So it's not at the antibiotics in like the neutropenic level. It's a step or two below that, but definitely we're not at the ground level. That's a good, thank you for translating. I appreciate that. Now we've talked about kind of two of, I'd say, more of the commonly used treatments, CAR T-cell therapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors. Any honorable mention? You know, you, in the beginning, talking about immunotherapy, you definitely rattled off multiple classes. Are there any other honorable mentions that you kind of want to briefly shout out?
Yeah, that's a good thought as well. I think there's two other medications that I'm at least commonly seeing in the ICU causing toxicity and toxic syndromes similar to CRS and ICANS. And these are medications in the class called lymphocyte engager-related toxicities. And there's two that are the most commonly currently, or at least two that I'm seeing the most common. And that includes blinatumomab, which is a CD19, CD3 bispecific T-cell receptor engaging antibody, also known as BiTEs, another acronym for you, and teclistamab. Blinatumomab specifically is designed to link CD19 positive B cells with CD3 positive T cells, which result in a cytotoxic T cell response. And the rate of CRS and ICANS is lower with blinatumomab compared to CAR T cell therapy, but the grading treatment is very similar to those. And then on the flip side, teclistamab is another medication we're commonly seeing with multiple myeloma. It's also a bispecific antibody that directs CD3 positive T cells to B cell maturation antigen, or BCMA, which is similar to the type of CAR T cell that we use for multiple myeloma patients. And the rate of any grade of CRS is about the same as compared to CAR T cell therapy, but lower grade 3 or 4, which typically is what we would require for ICU admission. Again, grading and treatment are pretty similar to CRS and ICANS, but vary a little bit differently.
So when patients experience adverse events on these agents, do they ever get re-challenged in a sense? Because we're obviously treating cancer. So when does the potential benefit of that treatment outweigh the risk of these adverse effects?
Good question. I think it definitely comes up a lot. You know, working in the ICU, we really only see these patients when they failed therapy or when they've had these adverse reactions and need to be considered for rechallenge or permanently discontinuing. So these are the types of patients we typically run into the most. I think it obviously comes up all the time dealing with the toxicities, though. In general, anyone who is grade 2 or below is rechallenged once asymptomatic again. However, once they reach typically grade 3 or 4 toxicities. So for pneumonitis, this would be things such as life-threatening, respiratory compromise, need for intubation. The guidance would generally say to permanently avoid these agents in the future. However, we can rechallenge patients who have previously had grade 3 or 4 ICI-related toxicities, but then again, that's specific to organ system affected. So for instance, myocarditis and pneumonitis-related toxic syndromes that have reached grade 4 toxicities, the recommendation in general is just to not try to recontinue them at all. It just recommends permanent discontinuation to prevent them from having those adverse events from happening again. Most organ systems affected by grades 1 to 3 toxicities can usually be rechallenged once symptoms are back to at least grade 1 symptoms or less. I will say that patients that are rechallenged, 1 out of every 3 may have recurrence of the exact same immune-related adverse event. So they may be in the same situation that they were before after they restart their challenge again. And at this point, if they reoccur their toxic syndrome, it's recommended, obviously, that they have to permanently discontinue that immune checkpoint inhibitor from future use.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, not only, you know, how these agents work, their indications, but then some of their adverse events and how we manage those. So recognition, prompt treatment, supportive care, all things that you kind of highlighted throughout the talk today. Obviously, feels like critical care pharmacists and just pharmacists in general could have a huge role with some of those things. So highlight things that, from a pharmacist's perspective, we could be all over in terms of helping for these patients.
Yeah, for sure. I think we definitely play a crucial role in ensuring appropriate monitoring and treatments that are in place when patients hit the ICU through a variety of different mechanisms. I think the number one thing is we bridge a lot of the gaps in communication on toxicities between teams. So between the pharmacy standpoint, the ICU standpoint, the primary oncology standpoint, especially when there are changes in things like ICE score escalations and ICANS patients. As these escalations occur, patients may qualify for treatments that they previously didn't. And these are time-sensitive therapies that need to be in place as soon as possible. So those communication gaps are definitely bridged by us being bedside, but also communicating with the treatment teams. I think clarifying scores that are being documented correctly and daily every day is super important. You know, even working at a center that's a cancer center that sees CAR T every day, we still struggle with correct and correct scoring and accurate scoring, especially with I-scores. And that's making sure that we're looking at the I-scores, we're talking to the nurse at the bedside, making sure that they're documented appropriately and every day. As again, these are also important for identifying optimal therapies that patients may qualify for. I think we also help with ensuring patients are on appropriate prophylactic medications once you have escalations of grades, specifically with ICANS. When you move from grade 2 to grade 3 or 4, they should be moving from general fungal coverage to mold coverage, actually. So that's something that commonly we're having to deal with in ICU, right, because they don't come to us till grade 3, grade 4. So we're usually helping with that transition, usually from fluconazole to posaconazole, and working with the treatment teams in that. Additionally, not letting any of the other prophylactic medications slip as well, such as our HSV prophylaxis or PCP prophylaxis drop off, as these are both recommended to be on for at least a year after post-CAR T cell infusion. So commonly these patients will go home after CAR T cell therapy, but if they get readmitted, we need to make sure these medications are still on board if they're back in the ICU. And then also AED prophylaxis. They need that for at least 30 days post-CAR T cell infusion, so ensuring that that's not falling off and that's staying on the MAR as well. I think something that comes up commonly is, you know, other infectious etiologies that happen concurrently, because, you know, CRS is happening, has a lot of similar features as sepsis and other infections. So our job is helping, you know, with differential diagnosis and considering these zebras and unexpected circumstances when trying to rule in or rule out infectious complications. And these are things not limited to, but include HHV6 virus, co-infections, CMV, strong gyroloides, West Nile virus, all those things are encompassed and definitely are helpful with ID consult as well. I think the last one that's also important that should always have a pharmacist on it is being involved in local and institutional algorithms and guidelines for managing toxicities associated with CAR T cells and immune checkpoint inhibitors. You know, we're definitely involved with this at the MD Anderson level, and we're helping with this with, you know, reviewing the data, reviewing the literature to make sure that we're including the most appropriate and up-to-date evidence-based practices with our guidelines.
Wow, what great highlights. A lot. And you even there's even so many things you mentioned that I wouldn't have even thought of. So what a, yeah, that's a must listen. Now, what are some of the biggest take-home points when you think about immunotherapy, some of the things you want the audience to remember? What are some of the biggest kind of summary or conclusion points when we're kind of wrapping up our immunotherapy discussion today?
Yeah, so a couple different points. I think to start, to remember that CAR T cell therapy and immunotherapy in general is here to stay. If you haven't had to deal with it yet, you definitely will. So it's important to become more familiar with the agents and the toxidromes that they can cause as they'll continue to grow and expansion and grow in the indications and the types of cancers we can use them for and the number of patients that will be hitting the ICUs in the coming years. I think also in general, we talked about cytokine release syndrome, and we should know that it's an expected toxicity from CAR T cell infusion. And with this, integrated systems for monitoring and treatment for these patients are crucial to promote safety and better outcomes for them. And in general, tocilizumab is your mainstay of treatment for cytokine release syndrome. ICANS is another syndrome we talked about today. It's an almost expected toxicity if cytokine release syndrome is or has occurred in our CAR T cell patients. Again, it's very important to have an integrated system in place for monitoring and treating these patients. And we know that steroids, tocilizumab, and potentially anakinra as well are your mainstays of treatment for this. Immune-related adverse events from immune checkpoint inhibitors can affect any organ system as we identified, but particularly skin, GI tract, and lungs, as they can occur at almost any time during or after treatment. And with this, it's important to know that the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors will also continue to expand more indications, which means more ICU patients eventually meeting that grade 3, grade 4 requirement. And the best way to mitigate their ICU stay is early recognition, identification, and management of their immune-related adverse events by the healthcare team. And the last thing I'll leave us with is, you know, overall care for these patients receiving any type of immunotherapy is complex. We've kind of identified that today, right? And it requires many healthcare team members to perform their duties. And this is not limited to, but include physicians, advanced practice providers, nurse coordinators, nurse educators, apheresis nursing, inpatient and outpatient nursing, cellular therapy technologists, case management, social workers, oncology pharmacists, critical care pharmacists, and so many more. So you can just tell there's so many, there's a huge web of people involved in patient care, specifically related to immunotherapy and the toxicities associated with them. All members really play an integral role in providing education to one another, but also in the constant and open communication when taking care of these patients who end up developing these toxicities.
Well, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. This is something that, you know, even if you're not a center that does this, you're going to have patients coming to your for one reason or another that have received these that might have adverse events. So appreciate you coming on, re-highlighting kind of where we are and what we know now. And that's another thing that you kind of highlighted throughout is this is evolving. And so something could come out in a week that, you know, who knows what that could change, right? So it's an ever-evolving world, but, you know, what we know now, a lot of highlights here, a lot of good stuff. So, Matt, we love that. But I think a lot of the reason that some people are still listening right now is the return of Mattress Mac. So we got to hear your experience with this gentleman with the mattresses. Let the listeners know what happened.
Yeah, so for those not familiar, Mattress Mac is a guy who owns Gallery Furniture in Houston, and he constantly is having deals on mattresses. So if you need a mattress in Houston, you're either going to get a great deal or you're going to lose a lot of money. So, you know, back in 2021, I think I was in need of a mattress, and he had one of the specials going on, which is usually around sporting events. But I think it was the national football title that Alabama was in, and Alabama was doing super good that year and were expected to win. And I think I had placed a bet basically saying that if you buy this mattress outright and Alabama wins, you get all of your money back. But if they don't win, then we just keep your money. So unfortunately, Alabama did not win. Ugh. And I paid a full price for that mattress.
That is, so are you, did you just pick Alabama because you were thinking with your wallet, or are you like an Alabama, like do you have ties to rooting? Are you like a Roll Tide guy at heart?
I'm not even an Alabama fan, no. It was just all based on money, to be honest. And I knew that they had been doing super well. So, I know, you know, like all of his deals, there's different odds of winning. And that, to me, after hearing several of them over the years, seemed like the safest bet to get my money back, you know, compared to the World Series ones he has or the Super Bowl ones he has. That definitely seemed like the game to put your money on.
Yeah, Matt Wana came on and talked about how he was an Astros fan and they made a huge bet and they lost to the Nationals when I lived in DC. That was the first iteration of this. So I'm sorry, definitely pulling for you in the future. If you ever, I mean, it's the ultimate roll of the dice. I kind of love it. I'm not going to lie. Like it's so if that ever happens again, you'll have to keep us updated. But Matt, thanks again. This was awesome. Talk about learning updates in a disease that's going to be more common, but that I think a lot of us are pretty unfamiliar with. This was awesome. So appreciate you, man. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Nick. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Matt. Remember, reach out to him on Twitter at MGM485. The reference list is in that episode description, as well as the website, pharmacy2dose.com. Remember, check out on social media for trial of the day videos and so much more at pharmacy2dose, T-O-2-dose, Twitter, X, Instagram, TikTok, all the things. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials in the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.